From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Halloween is coming, and of course, so is the Great Pumpkin. And Charlie Brown and Linus and Lucy and the whole gang. Peanuts creator Charles Schulz is 15 years gone now. But Charlie Brown remains very much with us. Something about the simplicity and humanity of the strip we can't get over. A new retrospective collection of Schulz's drawings looks at why, and a new movie opens soon with Charlie Brown in 3D. This hour on Point, Charlie Brown. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Charlie Brown in 3D, can they do that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Little Great Pumpkin. It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. TV special first aired 1966. Lucy, voiced by Sally Dreyer, convinces Charlie Brown, voiced by Peter Robbins, famously, to attempt to kick a football. It doesn't go over well. It never does.
You just want me to come running up to kick that ball so you can pull it away and see me land flat on my back and kill myself.
This time you can trust me. See? Here's a signed document. Testifying that I promise not to pull it away.
It is signed. It's a signed document. I guess if you have a signed document in your possession, you can't go wrong. This year, I'm really gonna kick that football.
Of course, and down he goes. That's 1966. 2015, hear from the trailer of the upcoming The Peanuts movie. The old gang, in its new way, is back.
Schroeder.
I don't need to fight.
Sally.
Yeehaw!
Linus.
Hey, Charlie Brown.
Ow.
Peppermint Patty.
Three.
Big Ben. Lucy.
You blockhead.
Snoopy. And Charlie Brown.
With that ubiquitous trailer voice behind, joining us now from New York is Chip Kidd, author, editor, and award-winning graphic designer, creator of the handsome new book, Only What's Necessary, Charles M. Schulz and the Art of Peanuts. You can read an excerpt and see a terrific slideshow of images from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Chip Kidd, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And from Washington, Sarah Boxer is with us, writer, illustrator, cartoonist. Her wonderful recent piece in The Atlantic headlined The Exemplary Narcissism of Snoopy. You can link to that at the website as well. Sarah Boxer, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Sarah, you say right off the bat in your Atlantic piece that Charles Schulz would not be too happy about the Peanuts movie in a couple of ways. Like what?
Well, I think he really liked to preserve, which he did in the television specials, this look of drawing, the sort of shakiness of the line. He liked what he called semi-animation, which is when the drawings kind of – the characters flip back and forth rather than revolve in space. And the new movie looks, at least as far as I can tell from the trailers – very 3D and in bright color, sort of busier than I think of the television specials as being. One of the great things about Peanuts is the white space, the beautiful white space. And so that's one thing I think that might be missing. The other thing is that the little red-haired girl, also as far as I can tell from the trailers,
always beloved,
is a
never
major
seen.
Character.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, it sounds like she's going to be seen and heard from quite a lot. And Schulz, I think, was really very careful about what he showed and what he didn't show. One of the big mistakes that he said he once drew was he showed the legs of adults in one frame with Lucy at a golf tournament. And he said this was a huge mistake and he never did it again. And so he really had a way of showing things through their absence.
Chip Kidd, you've got this beautiful book showing the evolution of Schulz's work with his tremendous simplicity and absence in many ways graphically, as Sarah says. You're a graphic designer. Describe the look of this new movie. I've seen the the trailer, and it's just a lot more filled in to my eye than the Charlie Brown strip and earlier television specials. And for that matter, to my eye, Charlie Brown, the way they present him, doesn't exactly, except in profile and when he's got his classic, you know, sort of crumpled half smile, it didn't look like Charlie Brown to me.
Well, first of all, I just wanted to say, in reference to what Sarah just said, I don't know, do you have my book in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Did you look at the first end paper as you open it up with the, as soon as you open the cover up?
Yes, I'm there. And there are the legs. And Charlie Brown with his golf clubs and Lucy looking up at a bunch of adult legs, and they look very foreign and strange here. We're not accustomed to seeing that. It's just them in the blue sky and maybe the little bird and Snoopy on the doghouse.
Right. So I'll get back to the movie in a second. But the real one of the missions of this book for me as a fan and an author and graphic designer, what have you, was to show a lot of the rarities and minutiae that had not previously been printed, because there are so many Peanuts books out there. Anyway, there it is. It's just that she referred to it.
We'll look at your book. We're talking about the movie. You're the graphic designer.
Sorry.
You must have seen the trailer. What do you make of it graphically?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's interesting. I want to give them the benefit of the doubt, and I want to actually see the whole movie. I mean, personally, I take issue more with the music than anything else. But I think, you know, throughout his life and his career, Schultz very much compartmentalized what was the strip and then what was everything else. And, you know, there were a lot of other movies made during his lifetime. You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. There were, you know, three-dimensional dolls were the first Peanuts licensed thing in 1958 from Hungerford Corporation. There were the Viewmaster reels from the late 60s, which showed the characters in three dimensions. So, you know, I think they've been true to the sort of the shapes and the designs of the characters. I think it just remains to be seen what happens with the story and if it's really true to the spirit of the strip. It was written by his son, Craig, and his grandson. And I can't imagine that they would want to do something that would not honor their dad. I mean, as knowing them as I do, and it was produced by Paul Feig, I believe. They're all fans, and they don't want to pull a fast one. They really want to do a great thing.
On the other hand, maybe he's got Charles Schultz, a singular genius there. We'll talk with columnist, cartoonist Michael Kavner later in the hour, who has seen a bunch of the movie, I think more than any of us have. Here's a little bit more from the trailer. Charlie Brown decides he's going to become a winner. He pitches a baseball to Snoopy, who's at bat, but it comes right back to hit Charlie.
Step one, forget everything you ever knew about yourself.
Charlie Brown is not a quitter.
Are you serious?
Not exactly the jazz music track that we're used to behind there, the nice piano. And you remind us, Sarah, that Charles Schultz hated the name Peanuts itself was hoisted on him.
Right. He wanted to call it Little Folks. And apparently there was another strip which was dead but still under contract still under copyright. That's what I meant to say. That was called Little Folks. And so he was not allowed to use it. And he also wasn't allowed to name it. And Schultz found the name Peanuts extremely demeaning and thought that it was saying that his strip was worth nothing and the characters weren't anything. And, I mean, now we look at the name Peanuts and it just means that strip. But when Schultz would be asked, what do you do? He said, well, I draw that comic strip with Charlie Brown and his dog in it. He avoided the name Peanuts altogether.
Of course, we heard there the Who chip instead of Vince Guaraldi and the famous jazz that we associate with. It's the Who, really?
I know. It's odd.
we'll see how people
one
like
interesting,
it.
Yes, Sarah. One thing that I did recognize was Snoopy's sound in there, and I think that the filmmakers used Bill Melendez's voice, who did the sound of Snoopy and the sound of Woodstock, and they used archival sound bits of his voice to create those same the old Snoopy sound and the old, I don't even remember what the Woodstock sound is, but so that I thought, now that's the Schultz I remember.
But I'm praying that they don't have them talking too much. I mean, part of this was always its very flatness, Chip, the way it didn't so much bounce to life, even when it was in a television special.
Yeah, no, I know. And the story of making that original television special, the Christmas one, is just so remarkable. They had an insane schedule on it, and they got the final go-ahead from, I believe, CBS in August, and they had to deliver it by December. And so the point being, economy was the only way they were going to get it done, and get it done, you know, the way they wanted to. So it is so flat, and the backgrounds are so, you know, watercolor washed and what have you. It's really quite remarkable that they were able to do it in the time that they did.
And the simplicity itself became a kind of calling card and much beloved. Now a new movie, the Peanuts movie, headed out with a very different look, 3D, no less. Chip Kidd is put together the beautiful new book, Only What's Necessary, Charles Schultz, M. Schultz, and the Art of Peanuts. And Sarah Boxer is with us. Her recent piece in The Atlantic, The Exemplary Narcissism of Snoopy. We'll look at that as well. Behind us, your good man, Charlie Brown, from way back when. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Lucy, and their creator, Charles Schultz. As a new collection of Schultz's work comes out and the Peanuts movie heads to the big screen, behind us right there, a little sound of the World War I flying ace, Snoopy's fantasy, one of his fantasy identities. Snoopy versus the Red Baron from It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, back in 1967? We've got Chip Kidd with us, author of Only What's Necessary, Charles M. Schultz and the Art of Peanuts. Big new book of Schultz's work, his unforgettable drawing. Sarah Boxer is with us, writer, illustrator, cartoonist. Her piece in The Atlantic recently was The Exemplary Narcissism of Snoopy. Sarah, you say that moment from the Great Pumpkin movie where Snoopy heads up and flies, a big change in the character we are presented here that became kind of a hallmark of the 1960s Snoopy.
Yeah, I think that was a key moment. I mean, the rise of Snoopy was a long time coming, and he was definitely beginning to be the center. In the 50s, it was really Charlie Brown, and you didn't even really – Snoopy didn't walk on two legs and didn't initially have thoughts that we could see. But at that moment, a good portion of The Great Pumpkin The Great Pumpkin movie has Snoopy chasing down the Red Baron, and it is totally in Snoopy's head from Snoopy's perspective. And it shows for the first time that Snoopy actually could carry things all by himself, was totally entertaining. And whenever Snoopy's on stage, so to speak, it's fabulous.
Speak to the narcissism that you're profiling here. Snoopy's narcissism, Sarah.
Well, he's been accused of narcissism. I wouldn't myself call him a narcissist, but there was a very interesting article by Christopher Caldwell that came out like a month before Schultz died, saying, you know, all these people who are lamenting the end of the strip, the end of Peanuts coming, really the strip died when Snoopy started taking over. That something about having just Snoopy there dancing and saying, you know, I'm ridiculously happy or something like that, mm-hmm. It just simplified things beyond the simplicity that was good. It was just, he said, it put it on the level of Garfield, where the main humor is, hey, look at me. I'm a dog. I'm thinking. I'm standing. Isn't this hilarious? And I actually think that that was not what happened. I think Snoopy really actually has great pathos. And the idea that nobody is ever going to see him the way he sees himself gives him this great freedom to make himself. But he's not a superficial character. He's deep. He's somebody who, especially at the end of Schultz's life, was the one who voiced a lot of Schultz's existential dread, which was considerable. So I think Snoopy is quite deep, and I don't think he ruined the strip.
The strip's cozy suburban conviviality, Sarah Boxer writing, its warm fuzziness actually conveyed some uncomfortable truths about the loneliness of social existence. And you remind us, novelist Jonathan Franzen calling Snoopy the protean trickster whose freedom is founded on his confidence that he is lovable at heart. I want to bring our listeners in. Omaha, Nebraska. Dave is calling. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I read Snoopy when I was a very, I don't know, what year did it come out? I can tell you how old I was.
Peanuts way back. Remind us, Chip, what year did we first see that in the newspapers?
Well, actually, started in 1950 and ran nonstop through 2000. So it's an
still
even
there, but in reruns,
years.
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There you go. I was 6 years old and just starting to enjoy the comics, and I found Charlie Brown and all the characters and lived that whole period of my life with them. And somebody brought out a collection of Charlie Brown's comic strips in a series of like 12 books, and I remember one of the first purchases I made after I got a job was that set of Peanuts books, and everybody kind of said, oh, that's interesting. But I learned a lot of life lessons through Peanuts and through the characters. And in high school, we had a friend of mine named Sherman Finger, and he ran for class president. And I hate to admit it, but I stole a picture of Shermie out of one of the strips and made a poster for him in his run for class president. He lost, but the poster was
of course, it's Charlie Brown. Hold the football and drop it. Pull it away. 71 and still loving it. Of course, it's interesting. There's a whole new generation, or maybe multiple generations, who have come to have their own relationship with Peanuts. And I want to look at that as well, how that may play out in the new movie. Michael Kavanagh joins us in just a minute here. A couple calls first, though. Sam in Boston. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to speak on the simplicity of Mr. Schultz's work. And it's deceptively simple, because if someone else were to draw a Peanuts character, even a professional cartoon artist, I believe I'd be able to tell which was the Schultz and which wasn't. His style,
that is quite true.
It was like, sorry, a fingerprint almost to his work. So clean. And if you go on YouTube and watch Charles Schultz draw the Peanuts strip, I believe there's a few videos out there, you'll be amazed on how quick this man worked.
Sam, it's a great observation. Chip, how can that be? I mean, it looks so simple, but if anybody else tries it, you know immediately. You agree, Chip?
I absolutely agree. Look, we all tried it when we were kids, and we never got the proportions quite right. It was quite remarkable, And in the early 60s, there were a series of Peanuts comic books that were published by Dell. And Schultz did the covers, but somebody else did the interiors. And boy, can you tell. I mean, you can tell it instantly. And it was part of why Schultz insisted that he would write pencil and ink the strips completely by himself without an assistant, and frankly, when he had a provision that when he was gone, nobody else would work on the strip. So it is remarkable. It looks very simple, but it's complex in its simplicity, if that makes any sense.
We got a listener here writing online saying Schultz's minimalist art style was both in sync with mid-century trends in design, quite true, architecture, yep, and serious art, and a necessity dictated by the newspaper syndication as it existed in his day. I guess printing and all that. Do you buy that, Chip? Was this a...
Totally.
So it was the format, it was being in the newspaper and a comic strip that made him go that way? I mean, there were others. I remember old comic strips that were not quite as minimalist as Charles Schultz.
Yes, of course. I mean, you had Chester Gould doing maximalist stuff for Dick Tracy and beautifully. But I think, Schultz wanted his own style. And at the risk of sort of overanalyzing it, I think that Peanuts did for the comic book page what a comic strip page in the newspaper, what the Bauhaus did for architecture and design, and that he reduced these characters to their most essential parts so that there was nothing extra, i.e. the title of the book, only what's necessary, but they still had a full emotional life. Which is quite a trick to pull off, and he did it.
Chip Kidd, please stand by in New York, and Sarah Boxer in Washington. Michael Kavanagh joins us as well from Washington now. Columnist, cartoonist, creator of the Comic Riffs column for the Washington Post. Michael Kavanagh has seen some of the new movie, the Peanuts movie, and spent some time with its creators. Michael Kavanagh, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Can you remind us of how you came into the world of Peanuts and Charles Schultz?
Well, I'm a Bay Area kid myself, and I can't remember a time when I wasn't reading the Chronicle over my dad's shoulder and looking at Peanuts. It was everywhere, and watching the specials. But I started cartooning professionally when I was about 12 and studying this at length. And then I actually was signed to the same syndicate as Sparky's, the syndicate that he had.
Sparky, the nickname of Charles Schultz.
Charles Schultz, sorry, mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we had the same comics editor, and I met Schultz in the mid to late 90s. And it was, I don't know who your hero or heroes are or is, but when you meet your hero and then he knows of your work, it's amazing. But what it let me know is I got talking to him a little bit, just some insights from the man himself, which only stoked my curiosity further.
And what about what you've learned and how you've learned it and seen it about the movie, Michael?
Well, in sort of full disclosure, it's been a long process in kind of hearing about this. In that, I was happened to be at a lunch with Lee Mendelson, the Emmy-winning producer of all the classic Peanut specials, including the first one, and he was instrumental there with Melendez and Schultz, and with Craig Schultz, who co-wrote this screenplay. And while not talking specifically about, they weren't revealing any specific film, came up future projects. So I interviewed the director about a year and a half ago, Steve Martino, and so all along between talking to people with the Schultz Research Center, we're talking with Fox Animation and Blue Sky Studios, I would pick up pieces here and there. And then I spent this past July embedded with the artists for a day and really got to go in deep in what their process is and how they are trying to be faithful. I think many of us, Sarah spoke to this, both Sarah and Chip, mm-hmm, this – this is one of the most beloved strips of all time. And that's it. It's different from when the Marmaduke film came out, and rest in peace, Brett Anderson. We lost him recently. But, you know, Marmaduke, and I was talking to Jim Davis recently, the creator of Garfield, but we're not protective of the same in the same way as we are of Peanuts. And so that's the core here. And I felt like the artists are protective, even as they're trying to bring a new generation into being interested in Peanuts.
Here's a little more from the trailer. Charlie Brown gazing out his bedroom window at the stars.
One of those stars is my star, and I know that my star will always be there for me. Like a comforting voice saying, "Don't give up, kid."
In case you didn't hear that, that was his star falling out of the sky. Michael Kavanagh was there, watching a team of, I think you said, 400 people working on this movie, and actually using some of Charles Schulz's own line drawing to somehow inform this 3D big screen version. How's it work, Michael?
Yeah, well, I think to contextualize this, I think the biggest challenge this film faces is traditional readers of the strip who are a bit, you know, middle age and older. They love the warmth of the line, the humanity, the handcrafted nature, the 2D nature, even in the semi animation of the specials. And then you have young readers who have never actually read a comic strip in a newspaper. And you need to get both audiences for this movie to really succeed, and I'm sure the way they hope it does. So to get specific, what they have done is, for instance, I saw footage with Pigpen and with the dust around him and how they do this in 3D. And I would almost call it 2.5D, because what they would do is they would scan in Schulz's own drawings of Pigpen's dust and then illustrate with that. So it's embedded. So you have Schulz's own line. Or the swirl on Charlie Brown's head, they took Schulz's own line and they volumize it so it's still, you detect his, and one last example says, Sparky was always very proud of how he drew rain, these beautiful, in Chip Kidd's book, I think his widow, Jeannie Schulz, mentions this. It was gorgeous how he drew rain. So they have scanned in Sparky's rain and used that in the frame. So in a way, they're hoping that Sparky's hand, actual hand, lives in this film.
Let's go to Elliot in Atlanta, Georgia. Elliot, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much. I had a comment. I should let you know, first off, that I am African-American, and I grew up in the African-American school, and a lot of I had some friends that were also Peanuts fans. I'm a huge Peanuts fan.
Yeah.
But a running joke that we always had was, why doesn't Franklin have any lines?
Franklin, the African-American character in the strip.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I saw a commercial, and I thought I saw Franklin speaking, and that kind of made me uneasy, because one thing I always appreciated about Peanuts was how simple it was. And I always thought that it was very progressive of Charles Schulz to put a black character in his comic book in the strip back in the 50s.
Yeah.
But I also, as I got older, I kind of jumped away from the joke about why does Franklin have any lines, because I realized it's probably Schulz being progressive enough to know that I don't know what this guy's, what his temperament or what his, I guess what his personality would be.
Hey Elliot, give us your punchline again. It just cut out for a second. Why doesn't Franklin have any lines, and what's the punchline?
That was the punchline. We were like, why doesn't Franklin have any lines? Like, he's always there, but he never says anything.
Let the black man speak, or what was the twist on it for you?
Kind of, sort of. But, I mean, as I got older, I realized, you know, maybe Charles Schulz is known. Like, I don't know maybe what he would say in this type of space. And I came to appreciate that. And my apprehension now is that they might try to put a character or personality on him.
Michael, Kevin, Elliot, our time is short before the break. I appreciate your call. Michael, can you relieve us of the mystery? Does Franklin speak?
I believe I can, partly because this summer I spoke to anniversary of Franklin entering the strip in the mid-60s. And so I talked to Harriet Glickman. And if you go to Comic Riffs and Google Harriet Glickman, you can find the whole story. I wrote it at length. Mm. Basically, she was the school teacher in California who wrote to Schulz in the 60s and said, you need to integrate the strip. And he wrote a letter back saying, well, here's, you know, we think about it. He said, many of us cartoonists think about it, and here's why I haven't done it. And she wrote back why it was important, and she convinced him. And some months later, that same year, he integrated the strip. And so on, and I will say that made waves. But by the same token, Schultz also acknowledged, he said, I don't know if I can speak for him myself. So he, again, he was trying to be authentic in this, in creating this character.
The Peanuts movie. Does Franklin speak?
You know, I've seen about a half hour of footage. I have seen him dance in a big scene with, and there is a lot of diversity actually in this film. There are other characters, so it's a greater diversity than in the strip. But I don't know whether he speaks in the film.
Elliot, in Atlanta, we're going to have to wait a little bit for that. Behind us here, the Great Pumpkin Waltz. We're talking Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Lucy, Charles Schulz, their creator, and the new movie, The Peanuts Movie. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Lucy, their creator, Charles Schulz. A new collection of Schulz's work has come out, and the Peanuts movie heads to the big screen early next month. Behind us right there, of course, Vince Guaraldi's much-loved theme. Christmas Time is here from the 1965 TV special. There were specials for lots of holidays. Chip Kidd is with us, author, editor, award-winning graphic designer, and author of Only What's Necessary, Charles M. Schulz and the Art of Peanuts. You can read an excerpt. This is a big coffee table book with lots and lots of images from Charles Schulz laying out the evolution of his graphic style, his style of drawing with Peanuts. Sarah Boxer is with us, writer, illustrator, cartoonist herself. Written for The Atlantic about, well, her piece headlined The Exemplary Narcissism of Snoopy. And Michael Kavanagh is with us from Washington, columnist and cartoonist, creator of the Comic Riffs column for The Washington Post. He's seen a chunk of the new movie, The Peanuts Movie, and spent some time with its creators, including the descendants of Charles Schulz. You can join us this hour. What do you, well, lots of questions here. Do you still love Charlie Brown? Why? And what was it about Charles Schulz's graphic style, his drawing, that made these characters so lovable? Is it the simplicity of Peanuts? Is that too much simplicity now or more appealing in 2015? A little Thanksgiving special here, Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, 1973. Here's Charlie Brown. He's overwhelmed when Peppermint Patty invites herself and others to his house for Thanksgiving, even though he's not going to be home.
How do I always get into these things? Now she's bringing Marcy, too.
It's your own fault, because you're so wishy-washy.
Hello?
Hey, guess who just walked in over here? It's Franklin. I told him about the big turkey party you're having, and he sure is folks will let him come. Hey, Chuck, this is going to be the biggest bash of the year. See ya!
I think I'm losing control of the whole world.
Yes, we all felt like that one time or another. Pamela in Fripp Island, South Carolina. Pamela, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'd like to just comment that I loved the fact that all of the child characters sounded so adult and so wise in their narrative. They were, Lucy was so smart when she was a psychologist. She always had like this great wisdom. Beethoven played the piano like a pro. Linus, when he did his famous Christmas carol speech, was just so profound.
Yeah.
And I get goosebumps thinking about how they were written as such wise little children.
They sure were. Pamela, I appreciate your call. Chip Kidd, what about how Charles Schulz looked at that, at the messages that his that his characters would carry, and their sophistication, their adult-like sophistication, even as they were tripping over footballs.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, I guess, worth noting that Peanuts as a whole, starting in 1950 and ending in 2000, is arguably the longest work of a continuous work of American literature that we have. And it evolved so amazingly during that time, almost decade by decade. But yes, I mean, I think it was clear that he was, you know, using these disparate aspects of his personality and giving them form on the page. I mean, I think a lot of people thought that the Peanuts characters were based on his own children. And sometimes he would get some ideas from his kids, but he would say that, no, they're really different aspects of my personality.
Sarah, are you ready to sum up the Charles Schulz philosophy expressed through his characters over all those years? You've got Snoopy's narcissism you're thinking about here, but what about Schulz himself, his intention?
Well, I think from the very beginning, there was a not messiness exactly, but a kind of cruelty in social existence. From the very beginning, you see Charlie Brown walking by and Shermie says, "Good old Charlie Brown." And then as Charlie Brown passes out of sight, you hear Shermie saying, "How I hate him." And then in the second strip, you have Patty on the sidewalk saying, you know, sugar and spice and everything nice. That's what, or she says, yeah, sugar and spice. And then she slugs the character, I think it's Charlie Brown, and says, "That's what little girls are made of." So there's this, in the very first two episodes, there's a sweetness to the drawing and a gentleness. Mm-hmm. And, but underlying it is this idea that social existence is not all fun and games. And I think that people really started relating to Charlie Brown because he was somebody who really voiced this first. Mm. And people said they were astonished to see the word anxiety coming up in a children's comic strip, which it really wasn't a children's strip, even though it starred children.
Look sweet, but the blues are right in there, too. I've got a little bit from
absolutely.
The Charlie Brown Christmas. Everybody may know these lines by now, but way back from 1965, and Charlie Brown's talking with Linus, saying he just doesn't feel the way he's supposed to during Christmas time.
"I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed."
Anxiety, depression, whoa, and we're in Peanuts territory. Stacy in Neenah, Wisconsin. Stacy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So for me, one of the most important things about Charlie Brown and Charles Schulz, which I didn't discover until I was reflecting, listening to your program, when I was a little girl, there were a lot of things that I needed to cry about but couldn't. And my very first memory of expressing feelings in public, I guess, and really kind of releasing was when I saw Snoopy come home in the theater.
And somehow that released your emotions, the Peanuts characters?
Yeah. I mean, there were things that I needed to cry about in my mm-hmm. life that mm-hmm. I couldn't, and just really sad things that were going on.
Yeah.
And this was, you know, I was little at that time, and people didn't talk about their feelings then, but for some reason it was easy for me to cry for Charlie Brown, who was losing Snoopy to Lila, the girl that was his original owner.
Yeah.
And it was so sad, but it was my life, but I couldn't cry about my life. I could cry for Charlie Brown.
Your path to opening up, Michael Cavanagh, does that surprise you?
Not at all. I mean, you know, if Peanuts had only been funny, it wouldn't be Peanuts. It would be discussed with you know, a dozen other strips. It wouldn't be the preeminent strip. And, you know, my wife is a psychotherapist, and we used to talk at length about each character and breaking it down. I think a key here is, one, as Sarah touched on, you know, he was writing for adults. I mean, that's where he was. He didn't want to talk down to kids, and that continued in the animations. What I'll also say is he could always tap that. Most great creators can tap that. So it was always authentic, and he always wanted to give you a range of life's experience. I mean, this is a man who profoundly had to take a train out for World War II, ship out as he knew he would never see his mother again. But by the same token, had all these warm memories of his dad's barbershop. And this was the man who was denied Donna Johnson Wold in real life, the little red-haired girl who turned him down after they dated. These profound, he could tap. I interviewed the real-life little red-haired girl a couple months ago. And, you know, she's very happy with her choices. But what it came down to is, you know, Sparky could always tap that. That reservoir of pain was there. So he was giving us a canvas of emotion and experience and a range, and he wasn't denying us. So it's one of the most authentic voices ever to appear on the comics page.
In the hands of a man who made comics, Frank in Lexington, Kentucky. Frank, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to echo what your guest was just saying there, and I started off as a scenic designer and so on, and I was always fascinated by the way that Schultz, with just an amazing economy and just a millimeter flick of a pen, could capture on the exact emotion, the exact expression on the character's faces. I'm going to use a highfalutin word here, but he had kind of a gestalt that he could call on to when he did his thing. He was able to merge the emotion and the expression, and he could draw out exactly what he wanted at the moment. And I think his contemporaries have learned that economy. I think one of the best examples is Bill Watterson's Calvin and Hobbes. The same sort of philosophical observations and the same sort of economy of line, and just being able, as a master like a Michelangelo, with just getting that exact pen stroke to do exactly that with no more, what do they say, good design or basically a good design is when there's nothing left to take away.
Mm-hmm. That's Charles Schultz, or Sparky as his nickname was, just to a T. We're looking at Charles Schultz, Peanuts, Charlie Brown. Chip Kidd, how about it? Your book is full of illustration of his evolution as an artist, that famous economy of line, and how just a millimeter or less moving that line could change the emotion, the attitude. What about our caller from Kentucky says maybe his sense of the gestalt he was going for was so strong that it's what informed that possibility. What do you say, Chip?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I mean, we in doing this book, Only What's Necessary, I worked closely with Schultz's widow, Jeannie, and a photographer named Jeff Spear that I work with for many, many years. And we basically camped out at the Charles Schultz Museum in Santa Rosa and just photographed original art for like a week and a half. So the emphasis here is really on seeing how his hand worked and how his style evolved over the 50 years. And I think I think it was Sarah that brought up that even with that first strip, A Good Old Charlie Brown, How I Hate Him, I'm big into form and content and how what something looks like works with what it says. And so he had this brilliant contrast of these two things, that if we look at the strip most of the time, it just looks cute and sweet. And then when you read it, it can be very trenchant and very, very emotional. And he handled that balance brilliantly.
Here's Schultz himself. This was in 1999, talking about his retirement and the end of his drawing of the Peanuts comic strip. He retired in 2000 and died that same year.
As long as I feel all right, I'll keep drawing it. But my children don't want anyone else ever to draw it. Mm-hmm. They said, no, we don't want anyone else drawing Dad's strip. And so when I either die or retire, that's the end of the Peanuts strip. But that doesn't mean that there won't be other things to carry on. I suppose someone can do animated shows or greeting cards or lunch boxes or things like that. I don't know.
animated shows. Michael Kapton, does that mean that Charles Schulz himself was anticipating what's coming out in the movie early next month?
Yes, I believe so. And I know this has been a topic of discussion leading up to the film. You know, I used to live not in the same town or one over from Audrey Geisel. And, you know, two of the big influences for me is
the
kid learning
widow
to draw.
Of Dr.
The
Seuss.
Widow of Dr. Seuss, Ted Geisel, exactly. And I was going to say two big influences for me in drawing were and having what you write and what you draw being, you know, achieving this gestalt. One was Dr. Seuss and one was Charles Schulz. And Steve Martino, the same director of the Peanuts movie, directed a Seuss movie and got permission from Audrey Geisel. And I had assigned a story where we interviewed Audrey Geisel, and she basically said, Dr. Seuss wanted the legacy to continue, wanted the next generations to know of this work. And I think part of what's at work here is I believe that Schulz wanted his creation to carry on to future generations. And let's face it, one of the boldest ways you can do that is through feature animation.
But here we go in this movie, going from that really flat sort of 2D presentation, even in the television specials, to this more full-bodied 3D look. Is the 2D, the flatness, not integral to the Charlie Brown experience, Michael?
I believe for many fans over a certain age, people who you know were reading the strip at least while Schulz was still alive, I believe it absolutely is, and I think that's the boldest thing about this movie. It's risky, you know. I don't think they're kidding themselves. It's risky to spend. You know, I don't know what the budget is. Usually for something like this, it's at least $100 million to go out there and try this. But I guess you go out and you do it. You hire the best people possible, and you try to be as true as possible. And you know what? You take a shot. But you can't kid yourselves. It's handcrafted in a different way. And I am very eager to see audiences embrace this.
We'll give Schroeder the last word on that. I remember the scene where Lucy's fawning over him and played again Charlie Brown. She asks if piano players make a lot of money. And he says, money? Who cares about money? This is art. Chip Kidd captures a lot of it in his beautiful new book, Only What's Necessary, Charles M. Schulz and the Art of Peanuts. Chip, thank you for joining us from New York today. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Sarah Boxer, writer, illustrator, cartoonist there, creator of the cartoon novel In the Floyd Archives. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Michael Kapton with The Washington Post, our thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much, Tom.
We go out with the Charlie Brown theme. Vince Guaraldi Trio, of course. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.